to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Most doctors are good at treating acute illnesses, but not at preventing chronic disease, says my guest today, Dr. Michael Greger. Dr. Greger is a physician, author, and internationally recognized public health speaker, and he speaks on the benefits of a whole food, plant-based diet and the harms of eating animal products. His international bestseller, How Not to Die, shows what to eat to help treat the top 15 causes of death. Dr. Michael Greger, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, your book so impressed the Dalai Lama that he wrote the foreword to your book.
That was very, very sweet. It's good to have fans around the world.
Friends in high places, huh?
Yes, indeed.
Well, I have to admit, though, sometimes when I would tell people the title of your book, I would get a reaction similar to what I just read in Time magazine. They said, death is non-negotiable. Something that can only be delayed, never avoided. So how do you defend the title of your book, Dr. Greger? How Not to Die.
Right. It's not how to not die, but how not to die, as in prematurely in pain after long chronic disabling illness. The good news is that we have tremendous power over our health, destiny, and longevity. The vast majority of premature death and disability is preventable with a plant-based diet and other healthy lifestyle behaviors.
Yeah, because the title goes on, How Not to Die, Discover the Foods Scientifically Proven to Prevent and Reverse Disease. Well, how did you get started in this specialty, Dr. Greger?
You know, I was, I think the spark for many kids to want to become a doctor when they grow up is watching a grandparent get sick or even die. But for me, it was watching my grandma get better. I was just a kid when the doctor sent my grandma home in a wheelchair to die. She was diagnosed with end-stage heart disease. She already had so many bypass operations, you basically run out of plumbing at some point, confined to a wheelchair, crushing chest pain. Her life was over at age 65. But then she heard about this guy, Nathan Pritikin, one of our early lifestyle medicine pioneers. And what happened next is actually detailed in Pritikin's biography. It talks about Frances Greger, my grandmother. They wheeled her in, and she walked out. Within a few weeks, she was walking 10 miles a day. And though she was given her medical death sentence at age 65, thanks to a healthy diet, went on to live another 31 years till age 96 to continue to enjoy her six grandkids, including me. That's why I went into medicine. That's why I wrote How Not to Die. That's why 100% of the proceeds I get from all my books are all donated to charity. I just wanted to do for everyone's family what Pritikin did for my family.
And it was appropriate then that you dedicate this book to your grandmother, Frances Greger.
Of course.
Well, you arrange your book. Your chapters are very easy. If somebody doesn't want to read your whole book, they can jump to the chapter that says, aha, I want to know about this. So how did you arrange your chapters?
Yeah, so it's the book is split into two sections. The first section is just 15 chapters on each of the 15 leading causes of death. So how not to die from heart disease, how not to die from diabetes, et cetera. And talking about the role diet may play in preventing, arresting, and reversing our top 15 killers. But I didn't want it to just be kind of a reference book. Yes, there's 3,000 scientific citations, but I wanted it to be a practical guide on, translating this mountain of data into day-to-day grocery store type decisions. So that's what became the second half of the book, where I center my recommendations around a daily dozen checklist of all the things I encourage people to fit into their daily routine. So, berries every day, the healthiest fruits, greens every day, the healthiest vegetables, a tablespoon of ground flax seeds, a quarter teaspoon of turmeric, the best beverages, how much exercise to get. Basically, just trying to inspire people to fit some of the healthiest of healthy foods into people's daily diet.
My guest is Dr. Michael Greger, and his book is How Not to Die. And he tells us what to eat to add years to our life. And I have to admit, Dr. Greger, you are preaching to the choir, because I try to live my life before I read your book. And my brother so wanted me to read your book that I was on my way to the airport. I was going to be out of the country for 4 months. He stopped at a bookstore on the way to the airport. He was taking me to the airport, got a copy of your book. So my copy has been all over Greece and Portugal and France.
All right.
and it's a pretty hefty book, but I didn't mind it at all.
It's good exercise, too.
In fact, my inclination was, as soon as I finished reading it the first time, was to start right at the beginning and read it again. Wow. Now, I want to tell you that in the studio is another person that agrees with you, and she has written books herself, and this is Lani Muehlrath, and her latest book is The Mindful Vegan. So I'm going to invite her, if she has any questions for you, to join us.
Well, I just want to comment that Michael's written such a brilliant piece of work here, because it's true, the mountains of research that, you know, we all go online, and if we have a particular problem, either with ourselves or with our family, and we look it up, and we might get the research or some kind of peer-reviewed literature, and it's just gobbledygook. It doesn't make sense. It sounds impressive, but what is that all about? So what he's done is taken that and interpreted it in a way that is user-friendly and fun to read. So you can go through and actually apply some of these things. And his Daily Dozen is a brilliant example of that, because that's Daily Dozen. That's not that many things to have to track. And who doesn't like berries and, you know, all of that? So.
Well, and it's available as a free app on iPhone, Android. You can download Dr. Greger's Daily Dozen and track your progress.
Well, one reason I wanted to tell you is that I'm not challenging the truth of your research, but my own personal experience, my husband died of lung cancer. He did not smoke. We ate lots of broccoli, and he exercised. He did everything he could have possibly done. And he still got lung cancer. So I, when I read in your book, you have a box, Smoking versus Kale, and you say researchers have found that kale might help control cholesterol levels. In fact, I eat more kale than anybody I know, and my cholesterol numbers are high. So I hope people won't pick out something like that and say, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Because you aren't, my feeling is that you're not expressing opinion so much as here's what the research says.
Yes, exactly. You know, yeah, about 10% of people that die from lung cancer never smoked in their lives. You know, and so when people hear something like that, particularly smokers, right, that makes them, they say, I've got an uncle that lived to be whatever, who smoked every day, drank every day. And, you know, I think it's important to take a step back and recognize, look, why, for example, do we put our seatbelts on? The reason we put our seatbelts on is not because it's going to guarantee we're not going to die in a car crash. There are people who put on their seatbelts still dying. But we do it because we know, based on science, that it reduces our risk. And so the same thing with a healthy diet and lifestyle. No guarantees, but we know from people from these diets being put to the test that they can help prevent, arrest, even in some cases reverse chronic disease. And so, you know, what else? What other decision in our life, you know, should we base on the best available balance of evidence? If you're, you know, just buying a toaster or something online, you know, it might matter what some opinion of some stranger out there has to say. But when it comes to the health and well-being of our families, I encourage people to really demand evidence. And because, you know, there's no more important choice you make in your life.
In fact, you start your book, the very first sentence in your book, there may be no such thing as dying from old age.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? So there was a study. Yeah, so that was the introduction to talk about the study done over in France. It was an autopsy series of looking at centenarians. So these are people that are over 100 years old when they died. And what they found was that in every single case, even in the cases where they appeared perfectly healthy, had no diagnosed disease, and then they just dropped dead, they died of old age. But when on autopsy, when they actually looked at it, there was not a single case. In every single case, they could find a cause. They may not have known the cause, and the most frequent cause was heart disease. So they had this occult or unknown heart disease. So they had this terrible heart that they just didn't know about it. And unfortunately, in about a half of cases in both men and women, the first symptom of heart disease is what's called sudden cardiac death, meaning that, you know, from you know, within an hour of that first, you know, pressure on your chest, you're gone forever, don't have a chance to reverse your disease. And that's why prevention is so critical.
My guest is Dr. Michael Greger. He is an award-winning author. His book has been on the New York Times bestseller, and the book is How Not to Die: Discover the Foods Scientifically Proven to Prevent and Reverse Disease. You arrange your book with your first chapter is on coronary heart disease, because it is number one. So what do you advise people in your chapter on coronary heart disease, for example?
Yeah, so it's really exciting that the number one killer of both men and women can be not just prevented and stopped, arrested in its tracks, but actually reversed. This goes back to 1990 with Dr. Dean Ornish's landmark lifestyle heart trial, proving for the first time ever that arteries could be opened up without drugs, without surgery, just a plant-based diet and lifestyle program. And so, you know, since that day, July 21st, 1990, no one else should have died, yet hundreds of thousands of people continue to die of this preventable, arrestable, reversible disease. I mean, we have the cure. We've known about it for decades. But unfortunately, the system is just not set up to push people towards these safe, simple, side effect free solutions.
In fact, I do find it shocking that medical schools seem to ignore this whole subject.
Isn't that amazing? You know, doctors have a severe nutrition deficiency in education. Most doctors are just never taught about the impact health and nutrition can have on the course of illness. And so they graduate without this powerful tool in their medical toolbox. Now, there's also institutional barriers, time constraints, lack of reimbursement. In general, doctors simply aren't paid for counseling people on how to take better care of themselves. Of course, you know, the drug companies also play a role in influencing medical education and practice. This, you know, you can ask your doctor when's the last time they were taken out to dinner by Big Broccoli. It's probably been a while.
Yeah, I feel that way too. I didn't want to say it, but I think you're absolutely right about that.
Hey, I think it's really good to underscore something that I've heard Michael, Dr. Greger say a lot, and that is just a few moments ago he said, it's important to have evidence-based when we're making these decisions about our health. And as he points out in his work, that the plant-based nutrition with whole foods plant-based diet is the only diet that has actually been shown to reverse heart disease. There's no other diet that has stood up to that kind of inspection. So as he says, shouldn't that be the default diet?
One would think, but again, there isn't Big Broccoli is not telling us
that's
to,
right.
to buy
right,
lots of broccoli.
Right, that's why it's so important to have great shows like this.
After a break, I'll continue my conversation with New York Times bestselling author Dr. Michael Greger, author of How Not to Die. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Dr. Michael Greger wrote How Not to Die to reveal the benefits of a whole food, plant-based diet. Well, this evidence-based, we need the information in order to make wise decisions, and we can't always trust sources of information, doctor.
You're never going to see an ad on TV for sweet potatoes or something. There's just no money to be made. I mean, it's not like, you know, the head of some soda company is, you know, rubbing their hands together trying to make, you know, children obese. It's just the system is set up such that, you know, produce, fruits and vegetables, it's perishable. They aren't branded products. You can't mark them up. There's just, and even a broccoli grower isn't going to put an ad on TV for broccoli because you'll buy their competitor's broccoli. Like, it's just, I mean, the system is set up to just dirt cheap ingredients, which is like, sugar, which is subsidized by taxpayers, into something that sits on the shelf for a few weeks. That's where the money's made. Or something like soda, dirt cheap ingredients, sell for a few bucks a bottle. Any CEO of any soda company that says maybe we should start selling something healthier is going to get thrown out because it's all about those quarterly returns for the shareholders, and the money is just made in junk. I mean, there's just more money to be made, and so it's not like there's some grand conspiracy. It's just that's the system we have, and so that's why it's important for people to take responsibility for their own health, for their family's health. You know, we can't wait until society catches up to the science because it's a matter of life and death.
Yeah, can I piggyback on that? Yeah. When people are introduced to this idea of plant-based nutrition for health, and there can be a bit of a surprise because everyone's used to the advertisements they see all the time, which, as he just pointed out, is because there's so much money behind it. So when people say, well, how can I change my diet in this way? Because it's obviously we're being told that we're supposed to eat all these meat and cheese and these kinds of products that are only so present in our media because they are highly subsidized by the manufacturers, the meat and dairy industry. So that's something that we have to figure out how to overcome. Why isn't this more out there? And as he just said, there's no money on it. There's no Brussels sprouts police, you know.
Well,
I think that's a good thing. There is no Brussels sprout police, but certainly Brussels sprout nudging. That's what I'd be in favor of.
Well, we pour a lot of money into research to find a cure for cancer, and we've been doing this for so many years that it may raise suspicion when you have a chapter and tell us, for example, digestive cancers or blood cancers. Prostate cancer, breast cancer. How do you advise people to what should our approach be to cancer? Because it strikes fear in people's heart. And I think if I were suddenly diagnosed with cancer, I would say, okay, doctor, just tell me what to do. I'll do whatever you say. I don't know if I would have the strength to make these kinds of decisions on my own.
Yeah, well, I mean, cancer is overall second leading cause of death in this country. And so the fear is certainly well placed. But, you know, after Dr. DeNornish conquered our number one killer, heart disease, he moved on to killer number two. And so he took men with early stage prostate cancer, put them on the same kind of plant-based diet and lifestyle program that reversed heart disease, and showed for the first time ever a reversal on average of the progression of cancer. And so on average, the cancers in the diet and lifestyle group shrunk, whereas the cancer in the control group, who continued to follow the diets that their physicians prescribed, continued to grow, as cancer tends to do. And so that's really kind of exciting to see that there's something we can do. We can empower cancer patients, cancer survivors with this information, and regardless of what else that they're doing for the cancer, whether they're opting for cancer, chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, in addition to whatever else they choose, they can always improve their diet and use that as kind of an adjunct therapy to both potentially affect the cancer itself as well as strengthen the person to withstand whatever treatments are ahead of them.
So what would be your best advice for somebody who gets a diagnosis of cancer?
So it depends on what kind of cancer. Different cancers appear to be affected by different foods and different behaviors. Some cancers, we don't have any evidence that diet makes any difference at all. But again, still, you'd want to you'd want to eat healthy just to be able to, I mean, having cancer is bad enough. You don't want something else. You need to bolster your system as much as possible. But, you know, so for example, there are some cancers unaffected by cigarette smoke, for example. But of course, you still wouldn't want to smoke because you don't want to get all the other types of cancers. And so, like, eating healthy is always the solution. But in terms of specific recommendations for specific cancers, that's why I have, you know, chapters on each of the different cancers, because there's different things that affect differently. And some foods increase risk of cancer. For example, eating these salted fermented foods in Japan and Korea increase risk of stomach cancer. And so it's both certain foods to avoid for particular cancers, as well as certain foods to include in one's regimen. And we have studies where we randomize cancer survivors. So for example, breast cancer survivors to ground flax seeds. So they make up batches of muffins. There's the flaxseed muffins and the placebo muffins, which taste and look the same but don't have any flax seeds. And you can randomize women with breast cancer to the different types of muffins and follow them out and just see, look, who lives longer, who has lower recurrence rate. And you can show that you can improve survival with these simple lifestyle tweaks, like adding ground flax seeds to one's diet. I don't think people realize that these kind of studies have been done and, you know, should be making, you know, front page headlines. There's a study I talk about in the digestive cancers chapter using strawberries to reverse the progression of esophageal cancer. This is why I can't believe that this wasn't like front page news everywhere. But you know, that's because there, you know, I guess there's no berry lobby out there sending out press releases, and it just kind of gets buried in the medical literature, just because there's no corporate budget kind of driving its promotion.
In fact, some people encourage us to not even use the word cancer to apply it, that it has so many different meanings that it's hard. It's misleading to use that one label, cancer, for so many different illnesses.
Well, there's certainly different risk factors for different diseases. So, you know, skin cancer, lung cancer, all affected differently, but they do share certain, you know, commonalities. And so, for example, you know, the anti-inflammatory diets, anti-angiogenic diets, meaning diets that strive to cut off the blood supply to budding tumors, may be able to improve survival across a variety of different cancers. Of course, some cancers, so-called liquid tumors like lymphomas, leukemias, blood cancers, really aren't a solid tumor at all. But you know, boosting one's immune system may be able to better fight off. And there we have the I talk about in terms of preventing multiple myeloma. Some things we can do in that chapter. And so, I mean, again, I'm hoping people will come away from this really being hopeful and optimistic and feeling like they have, you know, that some of that power in their hands over the course of their life and disease.
You know, I would love it, Lanny here, I would love it if you could also elaborate a little bit on what the biggest offenders are. You've given us a really rich idea about what we should add to our diet, but what are the important things to nudge out?
I'd be happy to take that. I mean, if there were three things I would first remove from anyone's diet, like if someone said, look, I can't do a lot, doc, but just like, okay, give me the top three bad, you know, just to cut out first. It would be, number one would be trans fats, these partially hydrogenated oils, which are already being pulled out of the food supply, thankfully, found mostly in junk foods. Number two would be processed meat. So, bacon, ham, hot dogs, lunch meat, sausages, that kind of thing. And number three, probably soda, which is basically just like liquid candy. I mean, those would be the three things I cut out first. And if there were just three things to add to one's diet, if you could only do three tweaks, probably I would add beans, berries, and greens to people's diets.
In fact, that's your part two in your book. You have topping that your daily dozen, beans and berries and cruciferous vegetables, greens. You have in that list, you've already mentioned flax seeds. That's another in that list. Now, there is something that you say you'll be surprised in when you're listing mortality in the United States, the number of deaths annually from coronary heart disease, for example, from lung disease. And then the third one might surprise some people. I have to admit, sadly, that it didn't surprise me. Your chapter 15, How Not to Die From...
From doctors, essentially, so-called iatrogenic causes. Yeah, no, it's really quite shocking. So, for example, just side effects alone from prescription drugs. We're not talking about overdoses. We're not talking about mistakes in terms of giving the wrong drug. But taking drugs as prescribed kills 106,000 Americans every year. So just based on that, sixth leading cause of death. In the United States is just taking prescription drugs as prescribed because of the side effects. And then you add on top of that the medical mistakes and errors and hospital-acquired infections and all these things. You add it all together, then actually the healthcare system comes out to be about the third leading cause of death in the United States. Now, this is not to say people should avoid doctors. What it's to say is people should avoid getting sick in the first place because, you know, hospitals are dangerous places. You know, you can go in with a broken ankle, come out with a life-threatening infection. Like, you know, this is, you know, we really had to keep ourselves healthy. You know, for particularly when I speak to young people, for people that have never really been in a hospital or never seen, a relative get really sick, or, I mean, people don't realize how debilitating illness can be. I mean, you know, you think of yourself having a really bad cold and you're just miserable and you wake up and your throat hurts. Okay, that's the common cold. I mean, imagine having, you know, one of these other horrible, you know, chronic pain conditions or you name it. And so, you know, and at that point, it may be too late to slow down or stop the progression. So, I just encourage people to, you know, it's never too early, never too late, but never too early to start eating and living healthy.
My guest is Dr. Michael Greger, and his best-selling book is How Not to Die. Also in the studio with me is Lani Muehlrath, who has her latest book is The Mindful Vegan. So she shares some of your, and I won't call it opinions, but some of what you encourage people to take a look at as far as their diet goes. You have diseases listed in your book, and some of them are increasing. I do take some I'm consoled by the fact that I think soda, you mentioned three things to give up or not to overdo. Soda's one of them. So there's some signs of encouragement for me. But I also understand that depression is increasing among teenagers, among young people. And you have a chapter on how not to die from suicidal depression.
Yeah, you know, when I was, writing the book, you know, I knew things like, going into it, heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, these things are, modifiable with diet and lifestyle. But there were other things I was surprised to find out were still amenable to these kind of lifestyle medicine approaches, and one of which is mental illness. There's this increasing literature now of studies, not just kind of cross-sectional studies where people that eat healthier happen to feel healthier and have less mental illness. Those kind of studies, you never know which came first. Maybe, people who feel healthy eat healthier, not the other way around. And so only recently have there been so-called interventional studies where you take people, you randomize them into two groups, and you put them on different diets, and you see and you measure things like mood and anxiety, and you can show that you put people on a more plant-based diet, and you can significantly improve their mood within just 2 weeks. And so that's really exciting. So I was really I was just floored by that data, excited to write that chapter. In fact, I'm looking forward to doing an entire book on lifestyle approaches to mental illness, and this would include exercise interventions for ADHD for children, and so it's not just limited to diet, but there's this increasing interest in looking at a relationship between, for example, the microbiome, the good gut bacteria you have, and not just intestinal health, but also immune health and even psychological health. We're talking about good gut flora. It's all about, fiber, resistant starch, all those goodies found in abundance, really only in one place, and that's these wonderful whole plant foods.
Well, there is one other thing I want to ask you about, and that is diabetes, because I think most people know, if they know a little bit about diabetes, they know, okay, sugar's off the list. What I kind of hate to focus too much on what not to eat. I'd rather focus on what to eat. So I'm sure you encourage people not to eat sugar anyway, but in your chapter on diabetes, how not to die from diabetes, what tips do you have?
Well, diabetes, another way, you're bringing up some of my favorite diseases. And the reason they're my favorite is because these are some of the few that can be reversed, not just, slowed down, but actually reversed. So type 2 diabetes can be cured with a healthy enough plant-based diet and lifestyle. And so that chapter, the high blood pressure chapter, the heart disease chapter, these are some of my favorites because we have so much power over these diseases. Even people who've had diabetes for decades may be amenable. We used to think that type 2 diabetes wasn't reversible at all. You just get worse, and you die. Number one cause of adult onset blindness and kidney failure and lower limb amputation. I mean, just a horrible disease. But we now know that we can stop this disease. We can reverse this disease with diet and exercise. And it really comes back to a very similar diet, and that's a diet that's supported by the best available balance of evidence, and that's the healthiest diet, one that minimizes the intake of meat, eggs, dairy, and processed junk, maximizes the intake of fruits, vegetables, legumes, which are beans, split peas, chickpeas, and lentils, whole grains, nuts and seeds, mushrooms, herbs, and spices, basically real food that grows out of the ground. These are our healthiest choices.
I want to ask Lanny if she has any questions or comments.
Well, that was like a perfect wrap-up. You slipped all those foods in there really quickly. And I do want to comment on his observation through the research of how what we eat affects our mental well-being. And I uncovered that in my research for the Mindful Vegan, too, that they've isolated the fact of improving fruits and vegetables in your diet in terms of content has improved mood, and it's been isolated from, oh, I feel good about myself because I ate more vegetables. It's deeper than that. So really important to look at. Yeah. Who doesn't want to be happier just by what they eat?
So I want to encourage people to pick up a copy of your book, Dr. Greger. Any closing comments you have for the listeners?
If they want more information, they're welcome to go to my nonprofit science-based website, nutritionfacts.org, where you can see all my work for free.
And you know, he does 3 videos each week of research, or 2.5-minute nuggets of information that you would get in your email box each week. So it's a way to stay in touch with the breaking news.
And also, I might mention, Doctor, that for people who say, well, I don't know how to cook, I don't know how to use flax seeds, you have a cookbook coming out, don't you?
Oh, we do have the How Not to Die cookbook. Yes, indeed. We were really honored that New York Times Review book called it their favorite cookbook of the season. So basically, it's just not only every recipe is healthy, but every ingredient of every recipe is healthy. And so it's like, wait a second, how do you make something sweet without sugar, salty without salt? These are some of the kind of challenges we had, but we're really excited how it came out.
Thank you, Dr. Greger. Dr. Michael Greger's book is How Not to Die. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with author and plant-based nutritionist Lanny Milrath. Her latest book is The Mindful Vegan. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Lanny Milrath is an award-winning health educator, speaker, TV host, and best-selling author on the subject of integrating vegan living, fitness, and mindfulness. She's certified in plant-based nutrition from Cornell University and has written 3 books. Her most recent, The Mindful Vegan, a 30-day plan for finding health, balance, peace, and happiness. Lanny, we've just been talking to Dr. Michael Greger about his book, How Not to Die.
Isn't that fun?
It was fun. And it's nice to see somebody who's enthusiastic and a proponent of a healthy lifestyle. Now, I want to ask you about your book, because you are similar advice, if I want to call it that. But what has been your approach to writing a book on nutrition?
Well, in particular, because the Plant-Based Journey was my book before, which really focused on how to make this change to this way of eating that Dr. Greger's talking about, a step-by-step approach. But I've found that very important to the process of making these change is being able to find a way to navigate your way through life's ups and downs without defaulting to old habits. How many people listening today have gotten all geared up for a healthy eating plan and it falls apart in 2 weeks, 2 days, 2 hours, or the same thing with a fitness plan or any kind of getting healthier or self-improvement project? And I found that for myself, even as a long-term educator, I teach in kinesiology at the college and university level, so I knew what to do about exercise. I'm well-versed in plant-based nutrition. There was still one piece that needed to be put into place for me to be able to implement them and live most skillfully. And that was the process of getting some degree of mastery over habits of thinking. And that's why I think this is critical to lifestyle change for many of us. So that's why I put it together in The Mindful Vegan. It's about how to make this lifestyle happen under the surface.
Because there are always going to be things that come up, I've got to go back to my old habits. You may not even think of that, but
You
do, because, for example, when I talked to Paula Poundstone, she said, she likes being a vegan, but she travels so much. She said it's really hard to eat this way if you travel a lot. So there are other times when it's a little difficult, and we've got a holiday coming up, Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And my feeling is, I want to be sociable. I want to participate with friends and family, and I don't want to make them feel like I'm some holier-than-thou person who's not going to touch the turkey. So what do you suggest?
Yeah, first, can I tag on the Paula Poundstone comment?
Oh, sure.
Well, as you know, I travel a lot, too. I've just come back from 5 weeks in Africa, and we were in a month in Indonesia, and we have found that wherever we go, as long as we're clear about what we are looking for, that fruits and vegetables and whole grains are in abundance all over the world. You just have to make it known, and it's getting easier. It's getting easier as this lifestyle kind of grows.
But in fact, when I traveled in China, I had a written out letter. I don't speak or write Chinese. A letter in Chinese saying that I was a vegetarian and I could hand that to the
restaurant. That's brilliant. We did something similar when we were in Africa at our first place. We explained everything we wanted to the cook, and he put together this beautiful plate of salads for us, avocado, carrots. There were beans. There were everything in this beautiful. And I thought, I'll just take a picture of that and show it to everybody else. Every place else we go. So that's what I did. I would show it to the cook. This is kind of how we eat. Oh, well, then it was easy for them. So if we can figure out a way to make it easier for them, which is, speaking of upcoming Thanksgiving.
Well, you know what, though, still, speaking of that, when you go to a restaurant, I have found that chefs really are delighted to have a request for something that they can do, but it's kind of ordinary. They're not cooking the same thing over and over. I often request, because I usually have some kind of vegetable.
Yeah.
I request a vegetable plate. It's not on the menu, but I find that chefs are often, they jump in with both feet and are happy to prepare something like that.
Yeah.
So back
to
now.
That's good. Well, the question is, why isn't that on the menu? Why is the assumption that everyone's going to eat a certain way, especially when we're getting information such as Dr. Greger has just shared with us, and that's more and more in the news. But when we speak of the holidays, people can be very wedded to what their traditions were and thinking that they're going to hurt someone's feelings if they don't eat a slab of the turkey or something like that. So what I like to do is, first, let's all remember, folks, that most of the foods on the Thanksgiving table are actually plant foods. We have sweet potatoes, we have mashed potatoes, we have green beans, we have cranberries, we have pumpkin and pumpkin pie. These are all plant foods. So first, let's celebrate that and realize that there's a lot at the table that meets that need. When it comes to being able to embellish the the family table. This is where it is really helpful if someone would like to help nudge the family in another direction, is to simply bring delicious food that is plant-based. And this way you win hearts. You don't want to come from the place of making someone feel ashamed or pushed or shoved, because none of us respond to that. But if you can celebrate on what's actually happening, it's a family or friends gathering, there's delicious food. And by the way, I brought this as well. It can go a long way. For example, at our house, and since I've been, you know, vegetarian for like 45 years almost and vegan for a big chunk of that time, it's simple because I even make a wonderful cranberry sauce that doesn't have high sugars in it. I have, by the way, if people want to see a pumpkin pie, I've got 6 pumpkin pie recipes on my website without animal products in them. So they can go to LandyMuellerath.com and type in pumpkin pie and you'll see some wonderful examples of that. But that's the kind of thing I do. And I make sweet potatoes and mashed potatoes, and I'll make some kind of a roast of vegetables with mushrooms and nuts and seeds and very savory gravies that doesn't require any animal products and none of these things that are threatening to our health, and they enhance our well-being and on many levels.
I'm talking to author Lanny Muellerath, and her previous book, The Plant-Based Journey, was her previous book, and she now has The Mindful Vegan. And that word mindful, when you talk about any meal, Thanksgiving, for example, but to, I think, approach food mindfully just increases the enjoyment of the food.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean when you put mindful in your title? What were you hoping to convey?
This is on two levels, Nancy, because one is, first, there are other books out there about mindful eating, which means just let's just pay attention to how the food looks and tastes and get more in touch with our hunger and fullness signals, because many of us, especially in this busy day and time, people are wedded to their computers, they're doing social media between bites, they're not doing what they're doing while they're doing it, meaning eating a meal. And this has many, many bad results. For one, is people end up eating too much, not eating enough on time, and not being mindful of really eating a variety of healthy foods. So that's on one level. And the other level is looking at other books on mindful eating. Not one of them that I could find really addressed looking at being mindful of really what or who is on your plate. So in other words, how can we be mindful in the bigger picture of what we eat? We know that some of the biggest challenges to our environment are our overabundance of animal agriculture. And we know that there are some real problems in animal agriculture. And this creates an unrest within us that we may not even be mindful of. It can create an agitation. And, you know, everyone says they love animals. And we all love dogs. But why is it then what we wear cows and eat pigs? So this gives you a chance to kind of look at that in a new way, which is what I like to do. I don't tell anyone what to eat. I say, let's be more informed about our food choices so that we can make selections accordingly.
I always think it's best if somebody can draw their own conclusions. If you make a suggestion, why don't you try this? They try it, and then they draw their own conclusions based on that. And in your book, The Mindful Vegan, you have your book arranged, a 30-day plan for finding health, balance, peace, and happiness. That's a lot of nice benefits there. But you do have 30 days, and you said, try this 30 days. And I thought most people, well, okay, I can try that for 30 days. So what kind of feedback do you get from people who do this?
First, is they're really appreciative that I put it together that way, because I didn't want this to be, oh, gee, that's a great idea. I'll do that someday and put the book down. I figured if I can, remember, I taught sixth grade for 20 years, so I am skilled and practiced in how to take what could be a challenge and break it down into incremental pieces so that the student, which is all of us, could grow successfully. So the way I start out this project is that day one, please, just 1 minute. That's all you need to apply to this process of getting under the surface of our busy minds and our busy lives.
And the reader thinks, 1 minute? I can do 1 minute.
Yeah. And that's what people say. And I also have audios that match this for every one of the 30 days, a 1 minute audio for the first day, a 2 minute audio for the second day. So that has been the response. And also, Nancy, there has been a response from people who are saying, wow, you're telling the truth here in terms of getting under the surface of some of our food and eating problems. Many of us, as I mentioned earlier, we know the right foods to eat, but how does it really carry out? We don't always live skillfully. So what I wanted to show people is how I moved myself from being a person with 30 years of up and down with my weight and difficult relationship with food eating in my body. Once I learned mindfulness practice, it teaches you how to move out of the wandering mind where we all go. We all think we have to go with every thought that comes in our mind because we haven't been trained how to do otherwise. And when you get some degree of mastery over that, you become better at making more skillful choices in your life, and that connects with your health.
I'm talking to best-selling author Lani Muehlrath, and her book that we're discussing is The Mindful Vegan, where she outlines a 30-day plan for finding health, balance, peace, and happiness. So your previous books, like The Plant Journey or the book before that on fitness, you really were aiming at health. And a lot of people, what draws them to wanting to be healthier is really a desire to lose weight. Mm-hmm. And people say, oh, if this will help me lose weight, I'll do this. And you say that along with that, you can gain peace and happiness.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. And I'm really glad you brought that up because this has been coming up more and more to my attention in conversations and presentations. And that is that an obsession with weight loss, I certainly understand the weight of the angst and anxiety of being overweight, having been there myself. But I found that the obsession with weight loss is not what ends up leading to a happy lifestyle. It leads you to obsession. So if we get under what's under the surface of a weight problem, certainly part of it is food choices. But even if you know the right food choices and there are behaviors that are getting in your way, self-sabotage, how do we get underneath the surface of that instead of relying on willpower and trying to muscle through, which just falls apart? If we can cultivate in ourselves a way of being able to create more space around life's ups and downs, respond with more skill and mindfulness, then these other benefits unfold by themselves, which is how I eventually lost that 40 pounds. I decided to just focus on a healthy, happy relationship with food, eating my body, do my mindfulness practices, and stop obsessing about the exteriors and build an open heart and mindfulness in my living and eating. And that's what happened.
And if people start now, they might find that they gain some of this peace and happiness before the Thanksgiving holiday, because I found a couple of different reactions. A couple of years ago when I was going back 3,000 miles away to spend Thanksgiving with my family, when I mentioned to somebody, they said, oh, sorry about that. I said, oh, no, I love getting together with my family. Mm. So I think for a lot of people, getting together with family, aside from what's being on the menu, is just getting together with family can be challenging in itself.
Absolutely.
So I think if people pick up your ideas, fortify themselves with happiness and peace before they get to the dining room table.
Yeah, and I really like to speak to that as well, because I've just gotten back from Alaska. My first trip there was just fantastic, and I spoke to the Alaska Vegan Society up there, and we talked about this a little bit. And the thing is, mindfulness also addresses how we are with other people and listening to them and connecting with people without an agenda. Most of us can't do that. When you're talking to someone, have you ever noticed you can see in their eyes or planning their response or their checklist? And then we notice ourselves doing that. We're building up this argument, and this is not connecting with people. And I
know two brothers that they don't really communicate because each knows what the other is going to say. They're so convinced that he knows what the other's going to say.
Yeah, and that's just a cycle that just keeps repeating itself. So what I'm really working on personally is to be present with people, even if they're literally across the table from me, you know, what I eat, is how can I connect with them as a human being and have compassion and kindness and not just push an agenda. And that is having wonderful result.
Well, I hope that people will consider, even if they can't find a copy of your book, which I think nowadays people can go online,
mm-hmm. look on for Amazon,
it,
any
The
bookstore.
Mindful Vegan. And you can start reading it now and be ready for the Thanksgiving holidays.
I even have some recipes in there that would be good to use. There's a chocolate mousse.
Thank you, Lani, for coming in.
Thank you, Nancy.
My guest has been Lani Muehlrath, and her book is The Mindful Vegan. For over 10 years, retired philosophy professor Richard Parker did commentary for North State Public Radio. He is a former columnist for the Chico News and Review and co-author of a textbook in critical thinking, now in its 12th edition. I've invited Professor Parker to come by today and tell us what he's been thinking about dinner.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm confused about all this business about what we should be eating. Half a century ago, a guy named Ansel Keys ran a famous study and claimed it proved that eating fat, especially saturated fat, would cause your arteries to clog up, your heart to explode, and you to collapse in a pile before your next birthday. Well, that prompted the low-fat, whole-grain craze that drags on today in many quarters. But that study turned out to be fatally flawed. More recent investigations showed that fats were not so bad for you after all. Yes, you can eat butter again, as the cover of Time magazine announced. What was bad for you was all those carbohydrates you get from the whole wheat toast you slather on that butter in the morning. I have an ex-wife who was a vegetarian for a time. She claimed she was perfectly healthy during that time of her life. She gave it up mainly for convenience sake, and possibly the temptation of a medium-rare filet mignon. I'm not sure. On the other hand, my sister, who reads everything she can about nutrition, has recently gone on a meat-only diet. She sent me a link to a video by some middle-aged prize-winning athlete who claims to have eaten nothing but meat for the last several years. I don't know. The thing these days, from what I can gather, is that carbohydrates, bread, pasta, sugar, all the stuff you like, cause insulin resistance and will give you diabetes in the time it takes you to mix up some pancake batter. You're supposed to avoid all that stuff so your body will stop burning glucose as fuel and begin burning ketones, whatever those are. And then there's cholesterol. Good cholesterol, bad cholesterol, indifferent cholesterol, and maybe many others waiting to be discovered. Bad cholesterol, incidentally, turns out to have two forms. Really bad cholesterol and not quite so bad after all cholesterol. You can find out which is yours from an analysis that your doctor won't request. Anyhow, I think I just got my cholesterol-lowering prescription filled at Costco when I stopped across the street at Barnes & Noble and picked up a copy of a book entitled The Great Cholesterol Myth, which told me to stop worrying about it. Now, according to the latest information I've run across, there's a new answer to the question of what we should eat. Nothing. Right. If you want to live longer and be healthy, stop eating. At least temporarily. Apparently, for some time, researchers have known that if you about half-starve mice, they'll live longer than their well-fed brethren. Quite a lot longer, actually. So if you cut your calorie intake down to the point where you go around thinking constantly about nothing but food, you might live to be 100. But of course, under those circumstances, it's hard to see what the point would be. Another, more fashionable way to cut down your intake is to do intermittent fasting. That is, you eat what you want some days during the week, and you eat very, very little on others. But this would mean I'd have to pay close attention to my calendar as well as my diet. It's just too much to think about. Besides, my sainted mother ate whatever she wanted to her whole life, and she lived to be 96. That fact hardly amounts to a double-blind random scientific study, but when I'm staring at a menu, martini in hand, it's good enough for me. This is Richard Parker.
Thank you, Professor Parker. I would also like to thank my two previous guests, Dr. Michael Greger, author of How Not to Die, and vegan author Lanny Muehlrath. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.